in Rome.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks for being here. Don't get scared, this is still a chalk talk, but this is my appetizer slide. So this is the experimental part. This slide shows you the experimental parts we are going to discuss today. And these are both experiments. These are images from Harvard Medical School of the fMRI experiment on humans that are lying close eyes. Is a magnetic resonance that shows you the yellow and the red colors, the high activity, whereas the blue color is the low activity period. At the same time,
what does the resolution mean?
In terms of, so X pixel here is a voxel, it's called a voxel, that is about 1 millimeter cube in real data. So the image is pixelized in little cubes of 1 millimeter.
What about the neurons?
Well, the density of neurons varies a lot depending on the system. The density is not constant. So, for instance, I can tell you that here, where the distance between electrodes is 200 microns, each electrode samples about 1,000 neurons. This is for the rat. So in both images, these are not data for the single neuron. A neuron also has a variable size that can go up to 500 microns. So you don't have to think of this as the single neuron signal. It's already the integration over many neurons that can be up to 1,000. Consider that in the human brains, you have 100 billion neurons and you have 100 trillion synapses. So you can easily imagine that, you know.
What is the time scale? Was this real time or?
What is this the real time? This I cannot tell you, but I can tell you that on the fMRI, I don't know. On the fMRI, I don't know, but I can tell you that For the neuronal avalanches, the avalanches last from, let's say, 10, 20 milliseconds to 100 milliseconds. So for the slices, for the slices, the time scale is the order of a few seconds, because each avalanche is on the scale of the milliseconds. Okay? So for the brain, for any neuronal system, the actual time scale is on the millisecond scale. Okay? So this is instead a slice of rat cortex. So it's a system in vitro. You have a dish with a solution that has some nutrients, and you cut a slice of the cortex of the rat. You keep the slice alive with the nutrients, and you put this microelectrode array that records the electrical activity in the system. So as I said, each electrode samples the electrical activity of about 1,000 neurons, and the color code tells you that more or less intense signal is detected at each electrode. The signal measured in this way is called local field potential. So it's an integrated signal that gives you the potential of an environment of neurons, not of a single neuron. Okay? So now I think we can, do you have any question about that?
Is there a stimulus here or is this just?
No, thanks for this question. As you will see in this lunch talk, most of my attention will be given on spontaneous activity. So, and I will explain why. Well, there is nothing to laugh about it. Consider that your brain spends between 60 and 80% of its energy when you do nothing. And when you respond to a stimulus, you have just an extra 20% of activity. So most of the activity, that most of the energy your brain spends is just to keep you alive. So if you just lie, close eyes, just emptying your mind, not moving, not listening to music, close eyes, you are actually do nothing, but you don't sleep. This is the state of your brain that is called spontaneous activity of the brain. As soon as you have a stimulus, you have a stimulated or evoked activity. Okay? Why people are interested in spontaneous activity, now I am redefining all my schedule, but since there was the question, it has been shown in the 90s, there is a nice science paper by Arielli, that the response to stimulus by the brain is the superposition of a component that depends on the stimulus, plus a component that depends on the status of spontaneous activity when the stimulus was applied. And the variable part, the one that actually makes the difference between different brains, relies on spontaneous activity. It's the spontaneous activity that gives the variability. And the variability in biological system is the key for survival. The healthy brains are variables. As we get older and older, our brain, our activity in the brain, loses variability. And this is the sign of incipient neurological diseases too. So we want a brain that is highly flexible. Okay? So let's go back to our question. And the question is, I don't know all of you, but I did the most of my research in the field of critical phenomena. So I am a theoretical physicist that I basically worked on percolations and related spin glass and related fracture problems, interdisciplinary problems. So I had actually nothing to do with neurobiology till 10 years ago. Since I got so passionate about this field that I started reading neurobiology papers, I say often as science fiction, because they are really, biology is really fascinating. And what I'll try to do today, I'm not trying to do a neurobiology talk, because this is not our field. I'm just trying to capture from neurobiologists the recent results that can be of interest to physicists. Okay? And that can justify why physicists in the last 10, 20 years have become more and more involved in the study of the brain. So why physicists studied the brain? This is the first question. Actually, we have a plenty of variety of problems in physics. Why attacking the brain? Well, the answer actually is fairly easy, because the brain is the best example of what is named, is called complex system. What is a complex system? It's a system where you know fairly well how each component behaves, but putting ensemble in, together a large number of components, each one you control fairly well, the ensemble of the components are able to install cooperative phenomena, cooperative behavior, that give rise to emergent properties. So the property of the single element is much more common, complex, is unpredictable with respect to, the behavior of the system is unpredictable if you start from the behavior of the single component. This is, for instance, in critical phenomena, the behavior of up and down spin in a ferromagnet that give rise to a spontaneous magnetization, even in absence of a magnetic field. So why the brain is a complex system? It's a complex system because people know very well now, I mean, I would say fairly well, to be honest, but they know to a great detail the component of the systems. And the system, the brain, each neuronal system is made of cells, the neurons, that are connected by synapses. So you have cells and connections. Indeed, in the last years, has been stressed that there are other cells in the brain that they are not neurons, they are called glia cells. And these glia cells do not connect with the neurons, but produce myelin. Myelin is a sort of fat molecule that recovers the axon of the neurons, the connection path of the neurons, and speed up the transition. The difference between white matter and gray matter in the brain is due to the fact that in white matter you have a high concentration of axons with a high coverage of myelin, and the myelin is white. So that's why you have white matter. So this glia actually turns out to be kind of relevant for the neuronal transmissions, and there are more and more papers in the literature that study nowadays the role of glia, even if it's not directly involved in the transmission. So as I said, I know fairly well how the neuron works. The neuron is a highly nonlinear object. So it's an all or none object, either it's active or it's not, and there is a threshold that is minus 55 millivolts at which the neuron becomes active. So this neuron actually integrates stimulation from the environment. This changes membrane potential, and when the membrane potential gets to a threshold, the electrical signal leaves the neurons and can reach via the synapses the connected neurons. The synapses are actually the way neurons have to communicate with each other. There are different kinds of synapses, but the most common in the brain are the chemical synapses that actually do not require physical contacts between the two neurons. There is an empty space, but in this empty space, that is actually very narrow, there is a lot of biomolecular mechanism, many biomolecular mechanisms going on, so that the charged ions can enter the postsynaptic neuron and the electrical transmission gets in into the network. So, nonlinear object connected by synapses. The interesting issue here is that this network of neurons and synapses is very dynamical, it's not static. In 1949, Don and Ebb supposed that synapses can strengthen and can weaken depending on activity. So if I have two neurons that are connected to the same one, if the activity of this neuron induces activity in the postsynaptic neuron, this connection will increase. Whereas if the firing of this neuron doesn't induce activity in this neuron, this synapses will decrease its strength. What does it mean, decreasing the strength? Means have atrophy ions channels, atrophy receptors, or else open new receptors, produce more neurotransmitter. So this network is not static at all, but evolves with experience. And if connections can atrophy, can decrease, they can eventually atrophy. So we lose synapses during our lifetime. It's well known that we have many synapses where we are born, and then we lose them in the course of our life. And this was like very sad prediction till a few years ago, but however now there are new results where actually synapses can also be born. It's called synaptogenesis. And it's basically what happens when you have a stroke. When you have a stroke and you do some rehabilitation, doing some rehabilitation induces the sprouting of new connections around the damaged area of your brain, and these sprouted synapses make the connection over the region where the connection was lost. At the same time, there is also neurogenesis. Neurons can be born in your system, depending on activity, and this is a very recent result, but still you have a lot of nature and science papers on this subject, and this is due to stem cells. Stem cells can migrate in your brain in regions where the activity has a problem. They can differentiate, become neurons, establish new connection, and make the network evolve. Of course, you can also lose, so we said that this is called pruning. So this network is really very dynamical in time, and all the modification depends on activity. The idea of Ebbs, that is 1949, was actually proven experimentally only 20 years later, when the phenomenon of LTP, LTD, long-term potentiation and long-term depressions that are the biomolecular mechanism were found. So Hebb, he had the really great intuition of synaptic plasticity much before the experimental facts induced this, prove this property. Still, at the time of Hebb and LTP-LTD, the plasticity was a property of a single synapsis, since it has been found that you have also heteroplasticity, the modification of a synapsis somewhere due to eye activity can induce modification in nearby synapses that actually were not involved in activity. And you have also a wonderful result that is called homeostatic plasticity. Homeostatic plasticity. Homeostasis is a magic word in biology. Tells you that the system self-adjusts to an optimal balance of something, of some property. And homeostatic plasticity that was found by Royer and Paré in 2003 tells you that if you experimentally induce a strengthening of excitatory neurons, nearby inhibitory neurons decrease, so that the average strength remains constant. So this is really a very striking result. And so to tell you that this dynamically evolving network is really, can really be very complex. On the top of all this, you have messenger molecules. One of them is the famous nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is a gaseous molecule that is present in our brain, and is, for instance, the molecule that is at the basis of the functioning of the Viagra drug, no? It's a vasodilator and induces activity in the brain. So,
Do synapses ever go the other way? Do they weaken, for example,
sure,
in people with obsessive compulsive disorders?
I'm coming to this. Okay. So if there is correspondence of activity, they strengthen. If there is not, that means this fires and this one does not, there is weakening of the synapses. So the idea we want to retain is that I have a network of sites and links, and that these links dynamically evolve during experience. So what is the question? The question is, how can a structure that is already quite complex and large can perform complex tasks? Okay, everything is based on the electrical activity, but how can we understand that the brain is able to perform as you know it does? So the community of neurobiologists is basically divided in two subfamilies. There are people who actually believe that the network of connections is the key ingredient that controls performance of the brain, and are all the people that are involved in the search of the so-called connectome, recollect and reconstruct all the map of the possible connections in the brain, and And lots of money has been devoted, both in the United States and in Europe, to find out this connectome, to reconstruct the structure of the brain. The other, this community actually think that the spontaneous activity of the brain, what you build on this network, is just noise, has no interest. There are some oscillations, but basically it's noise. And then there is another community that instead thinks that, yes, the connections are important, but it's very much important to what you build on this network, so the level of activity you are able to install on this system. So what I am doing now is to summarize very briefly, also because I see that the time runs, what we know about the structure, and then I will talk about the activity. So you can study the structure at very different scales. So you can study the structure in vitro. So you can put hundreds of neurons in a dish. You put these neurons in a solution that keeps them alive. These neurons are dissociated. They have no attachment. They have no connections. After 6 days in vitro, more or less, it's sort of a magic time, a network of connection is developed. There are beautiful works by the group of Ben Jacobs in Tel Aviv that actually follow this evolution. They map the network of connection on a graph and they study the properties of this graph. And what they found out is that in a dish, few neurons, few hundred neurons, this network has the properties of being small world. Small world for the people who are
yes. It's not clear how this happens physically. Are you talking about condensation of them in space, or they are still very sparse, far from each other?
They are very sparse, and then they
and
start
axons
to
grow.
Yes.
What physically connects them? Axons?
Yes.
Okay.
So they are alive, there is some nutrients, so they are able to perform, and so they actually sprout connections that in 6 days make a network connecting the different neurons. Okay.
And are these only excitatory neurons and not inhibitory also?
Well, thanks for telling me. Neurons can be excitatory or inhibitory, depending on the neurotransmitter that they can release. Okay? This can be done for both. It's not, doesn't depend on the kind of neurotransmitter the neuron can release this property of sprouting new synapses. Okay, so they can be both. Small world is a network that has become very popular in the literature since the discovery in 1998 by Watts and Strovatz, because it has the nice property to be in the middle between regular networks like square lattice, cubic lattice, and so on, and random lattices. So they have properties of the one and properties of the other. What is the advantage of this small world? Is that you have a very few, a very low percentage, 1 or 2%, long-range connections. This long-range connection changes drastically the properties of the network. So the network that spontaneously the neurons are able to build up is a network that has this property. You have many neurons that are locally connected, but then eventually you have few neurons that have a very long-range connection. This means that actual information can travel through very long distances. Then you can change the scale, and you can actually study the structure of electron of the network that you have in your brain, like the experiment I showed you before, via an fMRI experiment. And what it has been shown by looking at the correlation coefficient, that means the coefficient that measures how the activity in a voxel is correlated to an activity of another voxel at distance r, distance, and by computing all the possible, I mean the matrix of connectivity, and setting a threshold, so looking at voxels that have a correlation coefficient greater than a certain threshold, it's possible to look at the connectivity degree of each voxel. That means the activity in a voxel, on average, how many other voxels is going to affect. This is the connectivity degree, so it means basically in a functional sense, not in a morphological sense. It's not the same as the other experiment where you actually grow connection. Here is a functional connection. I have an activity here, I want to see how many other voxels I can affect. This is called connectivity degree. And what it has been found is that the distribution of this connectivity degree behaves like a power law. So there is not, what is a power law? What the power law tells you is that there is not a characteristic connectivity degree, like in a regular lattice, but also like in a small world. In a small world, you have a clear K average, because you just reconnect very few bonds long range. Here, you have no characteristic connectivity degree. You have very many neurons that are highly connected, and you have very few neurons that have an high connectivity degree that are called hubs. So the hubs are the tail of the distribution in the connectivity distribution. Why is this relevant? Because these are results that for the same time puts the brain on the same footing with other problems studied very much in the complex network community. People who study internet, people who study plane communications or food networks and so on. As you know, that there are thousands.
What's the dynamic range
for K? K can go from 2 to 100 about. And gamma is about 2. Okay, so it's not like internet. In social science, this is also something interesting. In social problems, this exponent tends to be larger, of the order of 3, like internet. In bioscience, because you can do this also for proteins, for other biological problems, the exponent tends to be smaller. So it's like there are different families of networks.
When
so,
you talk about all these things, I guess you're giving some kind of population average. Is there a lot of variability between individuals or very little?
About this property, no. There is not variability. Uh-huh. This is done, experiments have been done on about 20 individuals, and these results
20
are...
20 individuals?
Yes. Consider that is a pretty tough experiment to do, because you have to put in this tube machine a person and, you know, but this is it's not something
so
people like to do. But
these
exponents has been found in many different papers. Mm-hmm. So each paper is about 25 patients.
Educational levels, no, all these variables have been looked at? Or?
Sorry?
Educational level, gender?
No.
No, they have not been.
Included. No. And they don't depend on the task. You can also ask people to do something in particular, why the experiment is going on, mm-hmm. and this exponent doesn't depend on the task. Mm-hmm. So then there is a more recent paper that actually says that the network is modular, the brain network is modular, so there is a PNAS by the group of Hernan Maxes in New York, where he actually showed, starting from fMRI, by a very smart analysis of the fMRI signal, he showed that actually the brain is made of modules. Each module is scale-free, has this property. However, these modules are connected by very few long-range bonds that are weaker in strength, and are these weaker bonds that make the entire brain small world. And coming to a question there was before, being a small word for our brain is crucial. So having this possibility of long-range connection is crucial because experiments done on patients with Alzheimer's, Parkinson, brain tumor, different neurological disease have shown that the first thing that you lose when you are sick, you have a neurological disease, is the small wordness. So the network becomes more random or more regular, but it's not anymore small word. So the properties of the network is very important. And this result actually formalizes in the network language what is has been found recently.
The modular component satisfied this law and was like,
so you have different modules. Actually, the modules correspond to the functional area, visual area, motor area, auditory area, and so on. And then they are, of course, they are localized in space. And these modules are have very weak connections.
They're not counted on that N over K.
Here, there is N over K, that is K to the minus gamma. So each module is scale-free, and then you put many modules, many functional areas together via few weaker connections, and the entire thing becomes small world. Okay? So, but then,
K is the number of interconnects between voxels? Or no, with fMRI, you're not looking at individual neurons. So.
Well, yes, it's functional. So it's not morphological. I have no possibility in vivo to access the morphological structure because you cannot enter into this detail. What you can do is to see each little voxel in your brain, how it communicates with other voxels. So this is a functional connectivity. As I said, how the activity in one voxel can change the activity in another one, and how many of them, on average. Okay?
So K is the number of voxels that one voxel talks to.
Basically.
But if I ask the question, what is average K?
Average means average over the entire system, space average.
Logarithmically diverging for two, it logarithmically diverges, average. K average.
Yes.
Integral K.
Sure, in principle, yes. But since this is on a finite range, you don't have to integrate from 1 to infinity. You have to integrate from 2 to 100, so the average is well behaved, thank God. Even if you don't have many reasons to talk of an average if you have a power law. I mean, the idea of a power law is that the average has no meaning.
I'm trying to get more exact on 2 because it depends. It's larger than 2 or smaller than 2. And with which accuracy is it known?
I think he's asking on the small world where you have average K.
Average
this one?
It's always a little bigger than 2.
No, here you have the.
It's
a bit like this.
No. I'm talking about decay. Decay index, gamma or what? Is it 2 or smaller than 2 or larger than 2? Nobody knows.
I mean,
which means that average number is like 2 or 3 or so.
But it's not. This is not what is really relevant, if it's 2 or 2.2 or 2.1. What is relevant is that it's not neither an exponential nor a Gaussian.
Right.
There is no characteristic value. Of course, you have to think that we are talking like critical phenomena people. So what we are interested in is to see a power law, because the power law tells me there is no meaning in the average size, there is no characteristic size in the response, there is no characteristic connectivity degree, but the system can actually show a variety of connectivity degree from the very small to the very large. Okay? I understand this a flavor that maybe.
But roughly even at this level, each module has the same gamma?
Each module, yes, has the same gamma. This paper of Maxe actually evaluates the gamma in the different modules, and typically within error bars, I don't remember now the error bars, I mean, could be 10-20%, gamma is very similar. Okay?
How do they choose a time scale over which to call?
It's average over time. this average over time. You look at the average act in time, the correlation coefficient between two boxes I and j, average over the time signal.
And how many models do we have at the moment?
The exact number, I don't know, but you have between 30, around 30 modules in the brain. They are called the functional areas or broad mass area. And actually, they have different tasks. They control, actually. Okay?
And where is consciousness?
You know, now there are a lot of papers on consciousness, on nature and science, that try to... So there are some different opinions about it, but still, I mean, we are kind of far away at the moment.
Are people trying to do the same experiment you're talking about on a split brain case?
Left and right hemisphere?
Well, maybe? People without split brains.
No, so far I haven't seen any paper on that. Well, but now I would like to get into activity. That was actually the aim of my lunch talk, and I'm addressing only now. So what is the idea? The idea, as I said before, is that our brain has a huge amount of activity simply where we do nothing. And this activity is not just noise. Some people believe it's just noise, but this activity is not just noise. Usually what people observe before 2003 is this activity goes through oscillations, and like high activity periods and low activity periods, and we'll go back on this oscillation path. But then what happens in 2003 is that Banks and Plants had this smart idea to look at this activity at a finer temporal scale, so at the temporal scale of a few milliseconds. And so they were able, and this is the movie you had on your left, on your right, they were able to distinguish in a signal bursts of consecutive neurons, so consecutive electrons actually, not neurons, that were active in time sequentially, not necessarily in nearest neighbors, because we have seen the connection can be long range. And then there were a few beams of quiet. And then again, the activity can start elsewhere and involve more or less electrons, and so on. So they decided to look at the size of these consecutive bursts in activity. And for the first time, they used the word neuronal avalanches. So they defined the size of the neuronal avalanche. And this size can be measured or as in terms of the active electrons, that means the electrods that had the color dot in the movie, or in terms of the local field potential, the actual measure of the potential variation measured at each electron. So there are different ways to measure the size of an avalanche. And so what they realize is that the distribution of the size of these avalanches goes, is proportional to, a power law. Again, that means that there is no characteristic size in the response of the system, but you have a power law distribution that in critical phenomena means no characteristic size, and this behavior is actually scale invariant. That means if I take systems that are L1, L2, L3, different size, increasing the size, this power law actually scales with the system size, and the final cutoff depends on the size of the system. This is a clear indication in critical phenomena that, you know, something is going on, and this is the signature for us that the system may act close to a critical point. What is the critical point? The critical point is in general is defined in thermodynamics. Here we don't have any temperature, but coming from thermodynamics is the one of is the particular state of the system where correlations that the individual elements are able to install with each other are such that the range of correlation becomes comparable to the system size. So you have, as we say, a diverging correlation length. And having avalanche sizes that are comparable to the size of the system means precisely the same thing. Means that the correlation in activity, because having one electrode firing, you means that then you are able to propagate the activity to nearby electrodes. Having that the size can go from the single electrode to the entire system size is confirms the idea that the system acts close to a critical point. I say close to a critical point because now there is a huge discussion at the critical point, close to the critical point. I don't tell you what's all the details of this discussion. I mean, the interesting issue is that this experiment has been done on systems very different from each other, on dissociated neurons that are from the rat, from the leech ganglion, and for instance, dissociated neurons are neurons that are, with a pipette, you just break up the cortex of the animal, you make a jam, you put a jam in a dish, the neurons that survive attached to the electrode where there is the nutrients, the other are dead and you wash them off. So you have actually a system where one electrode has one neuron. So it's different from the fMRI. Really have the response of the single neuron. And in this system, you find a power law. The power law with an exponent that is close to 1.5. But then you have slices of rat cortex, and you find the same exponents. This was found by Plants in 2003. But you have alive rats and alive monkeys. So you can implant the microelectrode array in the alive animal. This is also something I didn't know, and it's kind of curious. The brain, if you touch the brain of an animal, you don't hurt him. That is, if you open the skull and you touch your brain, you don't feel anything. So the animal keeps on performing even if it has this microelectrode array implanted. And this, you find that this kind of, you know, it seems a paradox. And you have the same exponent. So more recently, the same analysis has been found on magnetoencephalograms. That means they are equivalent of the EEG, but where you measure not electric fields, but magnetic fields. And you find also that avalanches measured by the sensor, you can implant on the cortex of the human, exhibit an avalanche activity that scales with an exponent 1.5.
When they're resting?
When they're resting. Mm-hmm. Only when they're resting. Because as I said before, when you have stimulated activity, you have to superpose to the resting activity what depends on the stimulus.
So when you see size of the avalanche, the maximum size, when you total system size, the whole brain, it will include all the modules?
Thanks for the question. Well, to answer this question, I have to say that this is the experimental side, but these experimental results have been confirmed by a number of numerical simulations, different neural models, a lot of neuronal network models, it's Kevin's neurons, Hodgkin, Huxley neurons, Morris LeCard neurons, plenty of neuronal models. And people have studied this kind of spontaneous activity in simulations. There is, myself, I work more on a statistical mechanics model. I find that the same exponent. And actually, in all these models, independently of the network you put the system on, small world, scale-free, regular, and so on, you find this exponent. The interesting thing is that if instead I studied models on modular networks, What I found out myself, I found out that what is the limiting size for the scale-free behavior is not the size of the entire system, but is the size of the largest modules. So this explains why our brain gives you a hint, why our brain is has a modular structure. Because having a modular structure, you hinder the possibility that a stimulation in some modules may involve in the activity the entire brain. You want to select the response. When this happens, the system is epileptic. And so already this is a neurological disease, right? And in fact, I must add that some experimental samples can be treated with drugs inhibiting excitation or inhibiting the role of inhibitory neurons, and you go toward a subcritical regime, like you have an exponential decay, you don't have any more a power law, or you enhance in excitation, you can have a so-called supercritical regime with an excess of large avalanches. When you have an epileptic system, so you have that most of the time the entire brain is involved in the activity, this is no good, it's not healthy, and this is the sign of the so-called supercritical behavior. Okay? So a healthy brain tends to adjust to a critical level of activity where there is no characteristic size, and this property of being critical has been shown to optimize information transmission and optimize the so-called dynamic range. The dynamic range is the range in response the brain is able to give, given a range in amplitude of the external simulation. So the more the brain is closer to the critical point, the more the response can be variable. And as I was saying before, being variable is the sign of health. So when we get old, and there are a lot of papers by Garnett and Hall and so on, fMRI experiments done on people with different age range, and people that get older lose in variability in the response. So the brain is healthy because it's able to give a variable response. So now I can go on for hours, but it's up to you. What are the next questions? Then so I let you decide.
What you're saying is that it's sensible for the brains to evolve to be close to critical points in modules, so they won't be the whole brain. But because then a stimulus can excite them. What it scales. Excite them with very little stimulus, epsilon, if you're a critical point.
Sure.
But the avalanche itself, doesn't that require some correspondence between the avalanche and the nature of the desired response to a stimulus?
Doesn't require
Well, the avalanche itself is a firing of multiple neurons, some pattern, and you're not
So let me see if I understood the question. If you study the evoked response, so the response to a stimulus, you have always the same stimulus, and by optical image, like calcium image, or by fMRI, you study the level of activity under the same stimulation, you see that the system can have a very variable response. Doesn't have always the same response to the same stimulus. The variability in the response depends on the variability of the activity when you apply that signal. So even if the stimulation is the same, the fact that the variability is has no characteristic size, this induces a variability in the response under stimulation. Did I answer your question?
Perfect.
What is the open question?
Well, I guess I have to have some notion of how many possible responses there are in the time scale. So the avalanches are on a timescale of milliseconds.
Yeah. The avalanches are on a timescale of milliseconds. Yeah.
Whereas the responses are also on milliseconds or less or more.
Well, if your stimulus is a peak signal, so like a few millisecond signals, so of course you have to work on that scale. The response is on the comparable scale. So usually what people do, you show images. You have to look at a picture and find a T. There is a T hidden in your picture, and then you have to, this is the visual task. You have to look for the T that is hidden somewhere, for instance. Mm-hmm. Or the auditory task, you listen to something, and when you hear a particular word, you have to tap with your head. Mm-hmm. So usually, I mean, these are short time scale tasks. You are not looking at the, you know, these are very basic measurements. These are not like, you know, performing a complex task.
I heard a talk about these experiments you referred to with a live monkey and stimulating with some external stimulus.
Okay.
Like a face or characteristic. And the claim was that the brain was sufficiently specialized down to the single cell level, not modular, but at a single cell level, you would find responses, say, to the left profile of the face, but nothing else. Not to the right profile, not to the front, and so forth. She went through about 120 different such stimuli, showing that there are individual cells that respond to each of those. That sort of is different from a modular system.
Okay, the modular structure is something that is very well accepted now. I mean, Brodmann areas are known since
the modern system. Now I'm talking about, for, as I understood, the resting brain. But for
the resting brain has though always the same structure. Even if you have a stimulated activity, your brain is made of different functional areas, each one controls a particular activity.
But that doesn't necessarily imply that for both signals.
Depending on the signal, you involve different modules. If you have a visual stimulation.
From point of view, but if the response goes down to single cell level, like this monkey had three different regions.
Yeah.
Where there were cells that would respond to single types of stimuli.
Are you talking about mirror neurons?
Mirror?
Yes, mirror neurons, what they are called, mirror neurons.
That wasn't used.
She's talking about grandmother neurons. Neurons that recognize your grandmother. Individual neurons.
It has been discovered that there are neurons that fire, very specific neurons in the system, that fire each time a particular action is performed. So if you grab something, or if you walk, or if you do any other simple task, there are very specific neurons in your brain that light up. And these are the neurons that, when you are born, are the neurons that are set up in their state to, let's say, store the information of how this action is made. So I don't know if you ever played with a newborn baby, and you make faces to this baby, and this baby makes faces at you, the same faces at you, right? So copying the environment is a way the young brain has to store information to a of a particular thing. Because otherwise you would say, how the brain tells me that I have to grab this piece of chalk, how this action of grabbing is stored in the system. So in the neuron, it's true, there are in the brain, there are particular neurons that are called mirror neurons, they are like a glass. They were found by Giacomo Rizzolatti. He's actually somebody who is running to have the Nobel Prize because of this, because it explains how the neuron stores information about specific action. Now, I don't know what was your specific talk. I mean, I didn't listen to this talk. So if it was the idea of neurons that light up while some action was performed, it could be very well this.
Yeah, maybe. It's a woman who is at Caltech doing experiments there. I think she's an assistant professor. Very
What is the trigger for each avalanche, and why do they have this, like, a test of the brain to see?
The system is alive. The fact that the brain is alive means that there are molecules going around, and this trigger is due to the fact that there is a transmission of glutamate that changes this the neuron membrane potential and may trigger other. In fact, you in vitro, you have to put the system in a glutamate solution. If you don't put it in glutamate solution, the slices die, the neurons die, and you don't have any more activity.
But this is random? Is it random chemical?
No, it's glutamate. That is the receptor that mainly is an excitatory receptor. And so if you put it in this bath with the glutamate and other nutrients, you are able to keep, even in vitro, the system alive.
So in the natural brain, it has a frequency that's bigger for the avalanches.
Well, unfortunately, if I wasn't so slow and I would have gone through my talk, I could have told you, but of course I cannot, is that large avalanches and small avalanches occur at different frequencies. So you don't have to choose between oscillations and avalanches. Avalanches are compatible with oscillations. So these so-called nested oscillations, there are some particular frequencies you measure in the brain, the theta, beta, gamma frequencies is something you detect very easily with the NEG, actually corresponds to the fact that very large avalanches occur at low frequency, between 4 and 15 hertz, whereas you have smaller avalanches that can occur at beta or gamma frequencies that go from 30 till 100 hertz. So you have long, distant big avalanches that are nested, within which are nested smaller avalanches. So there is a complex temporal structure. This is why people were observing oscillations. This is not in contrast, it's just a finer understanding of oscillations. Oscillations are made up by avalanches of different sizes. To say if they are aftershocks or not, you should do the same analysis you do for earthquakes. So you should actually measure the rate as function of time, and say that the rate goes like a power law with an exponent, okay? This is something that clearly is not being done yet. But then what is the preliminary idea is that you have, since you have oscillations, so you have periods of high activities and period of low activity, in the periods of high activity, avalanches are correlated. Since they are correlated, you can very well talk of aftershocks and Omori law, which has not been measured yet. But then you have low activity period where memory is erased and where you have actually acquired the system just in the spontaneous activity, just recovers from the bursting activity, and there is this oscillation between high activity and low activity. Okay? So, but to talk about, to have the same terminology as you have in earthquakes or in solar flares, usually you talk about aftershocks if they are, you have events that are correlated whose rates the case as a power law, no? It's more complete. Certainly, avalanches are correlated. Avalanches are correlated in the burst periods. And then there are the quiet periods that erase the memory of past activity, and the system is able to start back. So there is not a memory over the entire history, but over these bursty periods that are called upstates, where the quiet periods are called downstates. So you have an alternation. And the balance between these periods is the sign of an healthy brain. I think I have really abused of your time, but.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
More questions?
Full. Listen, I'm trying to figure out if the power law and the avalanches and the power law and the connectivity are the same, or is it intact? So, but do I need that connectivity to get the power law and the avalanches, or can I get it from some boring connectivity?
This, of course, I can tell you from the numerical point of view.
Yeah.
So from the numerical point of view, I can tell you that I've tested networks that are not scale-free, and I still have the scale-free behavior in the avalanche size. The only thing that is kind of out of universality is if you use a fully connected network. That means every neuron communicates with every other neuron. If I use that network, I have a supercritical behavior. So I have I trigger activity in most of the time in the majority of neurons. So there is an indication that to have critical behavior, you cannot have a fully connected network. But Erdos Reni, regular networks, small worlds, and so on, they show always the same exponent.
Question. In the books I read, the word module is thrown around a lot. Is there a precise definition? Because it seems that you define it fairly coarsely, and you only have 20, 30, but some people are very fine.
For me, modular structure means that 92% of the connections are within isolated clusters.
So that's the definition, 92?
This is the definition that is used in this paper. The majority doesn't have to be 92%.
Because just from common experience.
So you have to imagine that these modules are very highly connected. A lot of bonds are here. Mm-hmm. And then only 8% of the connections are among modules.
Because from everyday experience, people feel that, for example, there's a separate module for remembering people's names, which is completely different from remembering, say, physics equations or something. So it depends. I mean, it seems 20 or 30 is too weighty to feel, you want to say. So it depends on how fine you define it.
Well, this paper, to my knowledge, this paper is the only one that has addressed the fMRI experiments with this idea of modules. And to my knowledge, there was to detect the long range ones, you had to change the threshold by something like few percent. So that means that this one are strong bonds, and they are highly connected with each other. Mm-hmm. And then if I keep on taking into account slightly smaller bonds, I get the weak one that are very few. So of course, if I change even, I take even lower threshold of strength, let's say I add more bonds, but then I become close to the experimental limitation. You don't want to put to take the noise, that because of course the system, the signal is very noisy in fMRI. So usually the threshold to clean the signal is usually quite high. It's around 0.4, 0.5. You don't want to take the noisy part because otherwise you get no information. But still, I mean, there is a pretty large.
I have a more general question. I mean, you briefly mentioned these large-scale projects, like the Human Brain Project in Europe, which is, I think, like a 1 billion euro project. And there has been recently a lot of criticism. As far as I understand, here the purpose is exactly to kind of map out this brain or to reconstruct it, right? But as far as I understand, recently the experimental community complained about, you know, it not being fair if I variable or there are no experiments, no tests or whatsoever. I mean, is that what you mentioned by the different communities, or what do you think about that?
I'm being recorded, you know.
Oh, sorry, I forgot your moment.
Let's put it like this. The theoretical side of the brain project, there is the project has some sub-communities, and there is a sub-community that does theoretical work, is made by scientists who do not really believe in this sort of critical behavior of spontaneous activity. Uh-huh. So it's more of the size, it's more the community that believes that the connection contains the entire information. I don't remember if I just told you at the beginning, the story of the neuron as this duality from the first start. Mm-hmm. In 1906, Ramon y Cajal had the Nobel Prize for discovering the neuron. The worst enemy of Ramon y Cajal was Camillo Golgi, an Italian neurophysiologist who believed that cells did not exist in the brain, but the brain was made up only of connections. So Cajal said there are cells, Golgi said there are no cells, and they were fighting all the time. At the end, in 1906, they got the Nobel Prize together, which is very funny because Cajal was able to detect the neuron existence through a technique, an experimental technique that was developed by Golgi. So the poor Golgi, I don't know if it's a poor, but Golgi got the Nobel Prize on a discovery he didn't believe in. But this is the sign that there has always been this sort of dichotomy in the community.
So that's a very diplomatic answer, of course.
Well, of course, I am part of this group of scientists who signed this complaining letter, but it's true, because now if you work in Europe and you work on brain and you don't belong to the brain project, you have no way to access any financing. Everything is controlled. I mean, this is the issue, is that all financing is controlled by this project.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You make predictions what the fMRI of epileptic patients would look like.
There are papers by Osorio and Zornet that actually study the power spectrum of the fMRI, the power spectra of epileptic patients. But then there are this paper by Cornelis Stem. So this is a medical doctor who lives in Amsterdam that did a series of papers on fMRI on different patients with different diseases. And this is the guy who discovered that consistently you lose a small wordness if you have a disease. Now, I don't remember if epilepsy drives the network more toward the regular or toward the random, because these are the two attractors, no? You lose small wordness that is in the middle, and you can either drive toward the one or the other. Now, I don't remember epilepsy. I remember that Parkinson, for instance, tends to be random, brain tumor tends to be random, and so on. But there are papers, these are beautiful papers by this doctor.
Didn't you mention the Hopfield model? I mean, 20 years ago, physicists were studying this model to understand the associative memory and...
Absolutely. The reason why I didn't mention it is because we are not dealing with this problem. We are not dealing with learning and memory, but as I didn't just very on a side mention all the variety of other models that have been defined for neuronal systems. Of course, the Hopfield model is a model that for physicists is very important because it has a clear mapping on models that are very well studied in statistical mechanics, but still this is not, they do not study the same thing. There they study the recognition of a pattern as an attractor in phase space. And here we are not dealing with memory, we are not dealing with stimulation, we are dealing with spontaneous activity. So what I try to convince you to, and maybe I failed miserably, is that you don't have to look only at evoked activity, but since 80% of activity of your brain is something you don't control with external stimuli, there is a lot of information even there. And this is what my focus was on.
Okay. So going back to the question about reconstruction of the connectome, besides the brain project, clearly a very ambitious one, there is the open worm project, which is about reconstructing the C. elegans connectome, which is made of 302 neurons. And recently, that's been done, and they reconstructed that connectome in a circuit inside a robot, and they show connecting the circuit to a sensor and motorial wheel that actually the robot, motorially speaking, acts exactly as the worm.
But you have also the work by Olaf Sporn, who actually reconstructed the connectome of the human brain. So it's not only the C. elegans, I mean, you can have. So there is an entire community that is devoted to the connection part. Which is fine, it's wonderful. I mean, in my understanding, I think you have to take into account both sides of the problem. You cannot think only of the connection. You have also to see how the activity lives on this connectome. You cannot have one without the other. But this is true. I mean, also in the States now, there is an important project, I think, financed by NIH, that is called the Brain Project, too. So it's
all right.
I forgot to say that all this was done experimentally at NIH by Dick Martin.
Thank you very much.